As I've already indicated, we would be turning this morning to John chapter 2, if you would turn with me. John chapter 2. Looking for a short time at this event, the wedding in Cana of Cana of Galilee. Having been studying through that first chapter of John's Gospel, I think we perhaps all recognize that this first part of chapter 2 seems to have something of a different character to it, that Jesus is engaged in a more obvious work, we might say. And as such, you might be more inclined perhaps to make a connection with the other signs that follow. But we might well take it on account of the opening words of this chapter to finish off, as it were, the week that began with John bearing testimony to Jesus back in chapter 1, verses 19 to 28. Would seem to be day one of a week. We don't know if it was Sabbath to Sabbath, etc., but it seems to be a particularly a seven-day period that is concluded on this in chapter 2. That is the way with John's Gospel. You can see a lot of different connections between different parts. Some people will try and fit it into a framework, but you can well see other overlapping frameworks and structures and so forth as well. I think that's one of the beauties of the Gospel. I do comment on this because I anticipate pausing a little bit after this in our studies in John. But before we do that, to look at this first of the signs within this first week. To look at it as well, because I think it does follow from what we have just not long read, that Jesus made a promise to Nathanael at the end of chapter 1. He said in verse 50, "You will see greater things than these." And these things, greater things, were to be the to indicate the opening of heaven and the, as he described it, the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. This is the first, I think, of the greater things in this witness of the Gospel that Jesus was to give by his signs. This is the first of them that we find here in chapter 2. We are reading an account of something amazing. There are many such accounts in different parts of the Bible, as we had read one back in 2 Kings, which in itself demonstrated the work of God. Here we have something quite amazing happening in what was otherwise a very ordinary event of life of that day. But as we read this, we need to ensure that we are reading it and looking at it in a special way, in the light of that statement that Jesus made to Nathanael. It's not just you will see greater things than these, but what will you understand by these greater things? Will you realize that when you see them, this is heaven open to you? When you see them, will you realize that as I, the Son of Man, am in the midst of them, it is about this interaction, this described as the angels of God ascending and descending, this is heaven and earth speaking together, dealing together, you might say. I did read a remark just yesterday from a surprising angle, from a surprising place, I might say. But the remark was that there are no miracles in John's Gospel. You might look at that and you would say, but what about this one? What about the others? Well, his point, the fellow who wrote this, his point was to emphasize that John himself insists that these are signs. He calls it a sign. This is the beginning of signs in verse 11. Which I think is to be our guide for our understanding of this passage. And it's where we started our studies, going over to the end of John's Gospel in chapter 20. There he said, "I'm telling you these signs so that you will believe that this Jesus who you've seen in front of you and you see in front of you today, this Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and it's by believing in him that you will have eternal life. The other Gospels do record similar amazing events, and we do tend to just gather them together and call them miracles. But his point was to say, well, always remember that John is presenting these things in a very limited number, because he tells us he wants to give us signs. He's signing something. He's signifying something. And that's what we must keep in mind as we look at such passages as these. They're great stories. But what are we doing with them? Do we deal with them the way that God means us to deal with them? Through his Spirit, through the Apostle John, who wrote this Gospel. In the other Gospels, these amazing events, perhaps we might summarize and say that showing us how the kingdom of heaven has arrived amongst men. And it's not all that far different from this. But John's great purpose, not opposed to that at all, but it's getting across the message primarily of who this Jesus was and is. Now, to look at this story, it seems to me that it's perhaps most wise and helpful to just first go through the story and make sure we have a good idea of what it's, if you like, the facts of the story, what's in front of us, just clarifying as we need to. But in the end, the important thing is to consider John's conclusion, which is right in front of us, which is also a record that's concerning the response of men to what he did. And so I'm simply developing it in this way to speak about the event and then to home in on the sign. The event then, first of all, just to trace through this story. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. There is something unusual here in that John is the only gospel to record this particular event. And some would say it's another argument to say, well, perhaps he was that other disciple. It seems like just a few of the greater number were perhaps around Jesus so far. It's still very early on. We've only met three or four, half a dozen, who are with Jesus so far. And perhaps John was therefore one of them, because as we hear it here, it does seem as though it's an eyewitness account. Seems to say that he saw these things happen, and not so many others did. But it is enough, quite enough, for him to highlight this as a sign. To begin with, it's fairly unremarkable. Just a comment, the third day, I've talked about the week, the way that the people of that day counted the days, it's much like you find at the time of the crucifixion. The third day, the days were inclusive, so number one is today, then there's tomorrow, and then the next one. So rather than adding on another 3 days, it's all included. So that does fit these days, that third day, into just the 1 week from that first time when John began witnessing. Then we read that Jesus' mother was there in a particular way, which almost might suggest that she was possibly even part of the organizing group. There's just something a little bit different about it when it adds that both Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the wedding. And really, we're just having the scene set for us. These are the people who are involved in this particular incident. Cana itself is rarely mentioned otherwise in the New Testament. So insignificant a place it was. And then it's a wedding. Some of you might already have heard of Jewish weddings at the time. Just as background here. They would go on for some time, around a week or so perhaps. And the information that the wine has run out would suggest that it was one of these long-lasting celebrations over the common weekly period, etc. Again, as background, this was something quite drastic. Wine would have been a very important part of that celebration. And the bridegroom was the one who had the responsibility for the hospitality arrangements, the provisions. And if they run out of wine, then it would reflect very badly on him. Perhaps it suggests that they were quite a poor family. We don't know. But he would be, at the very very least, he would be humiliated if the wine runs out before the celebration is finished. And apparently it would also have been possible, at least for the bride's family, to have taken him to law over it, that he had not met his obligations in that instance. So it was perhaps a bit more dramatic than we might first think. It seems to have been quite a concern that they ran out of wine, and thereby the mother of Jesus, she's always called that here in John's Gospel, she seems to have somehow or other, perhaps again because she was organizing, she seems to have known about this, and she comes to Jesus. Just to remember where we're at with these particular people. This was her son, her firstborn son. It's noted that through the rest of the Gospel we don't hear of Joseph at all. And maybe by this time, Jesus is about 30 years old, maybe by this time Joseph was dead. If so, then Jesus would have been one that Mary, his mother, had relied on a great deal, her firstborn son. I say this because there's other places where he is directly called not just the son of the carpenter, but the carpenter himself, that he has perhaps moved into the trade himself. Whatever that might be, it's just to try and understand something of what might be in his mother's mind as she comes to Jesus and says something like this. And we need to do that because we then see Jesus' response. Mary told him the problem, and his response shows that things have all changed from what it seems that she had been understanding. But until now it was almost as though just a standard, if you like, but very good mother-son relationship was in place. But in answer to her on this occasion, Jesus says, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." This hour has not yet come, it commonly does seem to make a reference to the crucifixion in particular, his death. But I don't think it can mean that in this case, because it's in the context of do something right now for the needs of these people. And it would seem to be more to do with his time for making a massive difference in the lives of people is not really yet come. It's her concern that he says, "You're concerned about that, but what does that have to do with me?" Bear that in mind, just hold that, because then it moves on a bit further, and she changes. She does change, maybe slight, but there's a change. In answer to him, she says to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." She's not demanding in any way now. She's just leaving it to him. As we've seen in the psalm that we read earlier, let God deal with this as he sees best. There's something different about this. Jesus brings out this change. He is showing her that things are changing now. He calls her woman. It's a hard one to get quite right in English. It's not not a harsh word. It sounds like it to us, but it's not. It is very respectful. But it is respectful. It is saying now there needs to be a distance between us. The normal things that have been going on, the way that we've lived our lives, it has come to the place where things are changing. His concerns are becoming something different. That's what Jesus was about here. He was signaling to his earthly mother that other things were taking over. And yes, his hour was just about there, but he had to say to her first, just at this moment, it has not yet come. She had to come to the point where someone else assumed a far greater importance, and that is, above all, his relationship with his Heavenly Father and the work that he was given to do. Do you remember when Mary and Joseph took Jesus to the temple for the dedication? And amongst other things, Simeon said, a sword would pierce through your own soul. He knew that Jesus would suffer. But he's saying, you too, you as his mother, you will feel great suffering yourself. It will be as though a sword is penetrating into your heart. Is this one of them? Where she would begin to feel that difference about her son. But she does persist with that different attitude. Turning to the servants, she's not demanding anything specifically, but whatever he says to you, do it. It does leave me wondering. It does sound as though she's, even on a human level, very aware of what a quality man he was. We read that elsewhere too, that he grew in favor with man and with God. He was a quality man. He was one to be respected, even at that level. But it's that answer or response of her this time, a different response, that does bring out his great work, his sign that he does. That trusting that is implied there, as if to say to the servants, now it's in his hands and all will be well. Then we learn he looked on 6 water pots of stone. They were stone so that they would be kept clean for purification. They were the water pots. It doesn't seem that there was water in them immediately. The description there, 20 or 30 gallons in modern language, that would work out to be something between, it tells us they were varying sizes. So if you do a rough arithmetic, it comes to between 500 and 750 liters. If you fill them with wine, which they were eventually, that's equal to somewhere between 600 and 1,000 bottles, normal size bottles of wine. Between 600 and 1,000. Now you go down to Sainsbury's or wherever and do some arithmetic yourself and consider how much this was worth. Just, if you like, by the by. But there they were, up to 1,000 bottles worth of water, first of all. They were filled. He said, fill them, and they filled them. Literally, they did what he asked them to do. They filled them up to the brim. Now, this is just one of these little details, but it's significant. There are some people who will say, well, maybe Jesus put something into the water to make it taste different. They were filled to the brim. There was no room for anything else. It does have significance. They fill them up to the brim. The next thing, draw something out and take it straight to the master of the feast. It was taking the water out that the water became wine. John sums it up so neatly when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, in verse 9. The servants knew, at least they knew where they had brought it from. It was the master who decisively indicates this is top quality wine. It is the best, the very best. And all we read then is how the master of the feast and, it seems, the bridegroom, they were left puzzled. They didn't know what was happening. This was in the back corridors, as it were. Jesus did it through there with the servants. He wasn't seen in this situation. And the way the story is left at the end of verse 10 is we don't know if they ever knew. It's the servants who knew where it came from. It's the servants who knew how it happened. It's the disciples who also watched it as well. But it's affirming that this is wine. Water that was put in came out as wine. All in the act of men obeying Jesus' instructions. There are a lot of things missing in this story. A lot of things that don't matter in this story. What it does tell us is that this wine was of the very best quality. There's no doubt that it was wine. No doubt either that it's clear that the servants left no room for anything else, as I've mentioned. It was simply water and then simply wine. And you couldn't take it out unless the whole was wine either. It's not just a layer on top. Just to bear in mind, because people will try and resist that this actually happened, that all the pieces are there to tell us. There can be no other explanation than that Jesus did something by his word as he directed these obedient men, and that what he did was something that's not been seen before or since. That actual event, water into wine, it was very much in tune with the way that God works. We've read of examples of that. One that we did read in Kings. We read of others in the other miracles that he does. It was in tune with that work, but this particular one was very different. It's not been done since. There are some people who say, well, therefore they won't believe in it. But John is saying, this happened. I saw it. I'm telling you, I saw it. I'm just giving you the basic details, just as you would give to me if something like this happened, or anything that happens to you. That's what I'm doing. It's very matter of fact. It's an eyewitness account. These things happened. How can you deny that they did? That, amongst perhaps a few other things that we might also bear in mind from this passage, as long as we don't take them out of the context. Some will look here and say that this shows that Jesus was fine with wine, that intoxicating stuff. They were well drunk, it tells us in verse 10, and the word does mean drunk. The reason that they would normally give the best at the beginning is because after they were drunk, their sensitivity, they wouldn't appreciate good quality wine if it came late. That's just the background to this. But they were drinking wine that would intoxicate. But that was over a period of time, because, commonly speaking, the wine of the time was greatly diluted. So be careful how you lift out of this just what Jesus might indicate towards wine. And remember, too, that one of the reasons that they would use this is that they didn't have all the other healthy, clean alternatives that we would have today. You go to a wedding today, you have a huge range of things. Whereas there it was water, which was filthy, unless it was from a well perhaps, or wine. And the wine would often be included as a purifying element. That, by the way, but it's something that people will do with this passage. That, by the way, because it is not what John is emphasizing here. Perhaps more suitably, again, not quite John's emphasis, but more suitably, there is also the point about the Lord's generosity. Also, by the way, it's almost in passing that the Lord does this, just as it was with the feeding of the thousands. It was to say, I am the bread of life. But still, there is the liberality, there's the generosity of the Lord here. Remember that calculation of 1,000 bottles of the best quality wine. Evaluate that. This is Jesus, as it were, his gift to this young couple who were in desperate straits. Starting out in life. The guests wouldn't use all this, as they were towards the end of the celebration. And it was all done quite anonymously towards them at that stage. But do remember, as James puts it, he talks about something different from wine. He talks about wisdom. He says, let him ask of God. He talks about the character of God. Let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach. Ask, and it will be given to him. But, I've said, this is not the main thing. This writer, under the inspiration of God's own Spirit, tells us of the reason why we hear of these things. Because this event is a sign. Try to just sketch out that, just fill out that event a little bit more so that we can see some of the particularly significant aspects of it, so that we'll understand how it can be a sign a bit better. And this is what it is about, if you like, a text for this morning. This is the beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. It's a story that's amazing enough. But why do we get what we get about this story? I said it already, it's not complete. If you were telling the story, there might be a whole lot more. You might even give the names of the couple, and so on. It's not complete. But it's complete enough to tell us something about this person. It is a sign done by Jesus. How is it a sign? What's it a sign to? What's it a sign for? Our lead is there. The sign Jesus did, manifesting his glory. And his disciples believed, therefore he manifested his glory so that his disciples would believe. Look at this water into wine. Don't get distracted by the details. You can learn certain things which I've touched on. But look at it first and primarily as a demonstration, a showing, a manifestation of his glory, Jesus' glory. Back in chapter 1 and verse 14, we read, "The Word became flesh," that is, he became Jesus, "and dwelt among us, and we beheld," we saw intently, saw with understanding his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Remember that. He manifested his glory, he demonstrated, he showed it to the people around him, not many, his disciples in particular. We beheld his glory. We saw it. Some ways, this realization of exactly what this glory was only complete at the end. It only really fully came after his death and his resurrection. But we are finding here that a glimpse of it is already opening up. You will see heaven open. They're starting to see. It is a sign to the disciples concerning him. They saw his glory. They saw, they heard all that had transpired. They could see that in some measure, in the amazing nature of this work, that heaven was opening to them. The glory he showed was that of the only begotten of the Father. He was the one that would bring heaven and earth together, as he had spoken of to Nathanael. And these things were opening to them in the person of this one in front of them, Jesus of Nazareth. And apparently just a small group around him, his disciples, those who were with him, they believed. It's not just that vague faith that we hear some speaking of today, and they wouldn't know what they're believing in, what their faith is in. This was faith, a trust, a belief in this person, the person that they have seen do the impossible, a truly greater thing than he had first done with Nathanael. He said that he would do greater things that they would see. And then he did them. Maybe you could pursue this point yourself. He said it in chapter 1, then he began to do these works in chapter 2. Isn't that the way with God? He said about Jesus himself, long before, often before, it's all said, it's all been told. Now he does it. Through Moses, God said to him, "You will know this great prophet, because he will say things and they will come about. They will happen." That's why Paul says later on to the Corinthians, he says, "All the promises of God in him are yes, and in him amen. They're fulfilled, they're done in him, to the glory of God through us." See these things. Things that he has told us he will do and believe. I think that is a part of why they believed. They had, we might say, they had followed, they had accepted him to some degree previously. It was a further step on. They believed in him. But John also wrote later on, but I think one of the key texts in the whole gospel, chapter 20, verse 31, he says, "These things are written so that you You open the book, that's you. That word which is jumps out at you, that you may believe that this Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. It's for you that Jesus, that John tells us this. It's for you that Jesus says, these disciples believed because he showed his glory. What about you? It's for you to believe. Why should you and I spend time on details of a report of an event in a remote village of Galilee, of a wedding, and we don't know the names of this couple? Why? Because it is a sign. John has told us the minimum, but he's told us quite enough. He's told us with little details that tell us it did happen. And as it happened, it was seen, it was heard, it was believed, and now it is testified to by these people. John is telling us the story. He's the only one who does. But there were others around him at the time. He is telling it on their behalf. They bear witness. And in other ways, they had no reason to believe. Jesus of Nazareth, Nathanael summed it up. He said, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Who is this Jesus of Nazareth? Where is Cana? What is it? What are all of these things? Why should we believe? We should believe because of what you see in front of you, because of the signs, pointing to who he really is. Underneath all that, if you like. These people had no reason to believe, first of all, but they couldn't escape believing when they saw what was in front of them. This, friends, is history. Here men in history saw this event where a man, as they thought, showed a glory that can only be described as the glory of the only begotten of the Father. These are such men who would be very unlikely to believe if such a thing was only told them. But they saw it, and they could find no other answer but to believe in him as the Son of God. Of course, no one else has turned water into wine in such a way. But this is history. God has done it. Once, that's all that's necessary. He gives us a sign. And that sign leaves you to give an answer. You see a sign on the road, will you turn or will you go on? What will you do with this sign? This is a sign that is pointing you to look on Jesus. See what you will see. The disciples were spending time. I gave a message just a few days ago saying, what did the men see in Jesus? They spent time with him and they saw things that convinced them. They saw this. It convinced them that they should believe. They saw the sign and they trusted in him. And they, in the person of John, they call on you to believe in him too. John says, that's my reason for giving you this. So that you will believe. And it's by believing that you'll have eternal life. By implication, no other way. It's this one. Who turned water into wine. It's a bit of a cliche, a little label that we might throw out from time to time. Think about it. That's what it's about. They believed in him. The conclusion to this has to be the question, will you believe? Do you believe, but will you go on believing? Will you believe, perhaps for the first time? I call on you to consider the facts of the case and recognize the sign. When you see it, think on what it's pointing you to and go there. Go to Jesus. Go and see there his glory, the only begotten of the Father. The glory of the Son of God, who has demonstrated that's who he is. That Jesus, this man Jesus, is the Christ, the Son of God. And he's not just stuck there in antiquity of 2,000 years ago in an obscure village. These things remain true. They were done. And the rest of the story is true. the rest of the story that tells us he still lives. He lives in all this same generosity. It's best seen in his giving of himself, holding nothing back. The most profuse of gifts. The water of life, the bread of life. Without restraint, the fullness of him, given for you. That's where this sign is pointing. He shows his glory to us today in this record. That's right, it's good that you too should believe in him. Pray God grant his blessing on his word today.